Vendors could complete selling the pop and all the stuff. The game is going to start here pretty soon. Peanuts popcorn. If the MMA wants to come down and get set up, that'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Signed over.
Thank you.
I haven't got a format right.
Thank you, Ben.
Hi, Ken.
Good, thank you.
Yeah, if there's a seat by you and there's someone appears that they would like to sit there, maybe wave your hand or something, one of the ushers could assist you. We need ushers. I don't know. Who's... Okay. Mr. Renner can be quiet. That would help. Who's coming for the MMA to do their presentation? Okay. So if Janet and Eric want to come down, Mr. Dick and Ms. Silversmith want to come down and have a chair there, just to get set up while we're milling around. Well, it's nice to see all the people coming today to... I know it's some of the care providers are here with ARM and other groups, and thank you for that. To those of you who do that service, we are in your debt as you serve people that are that you get to love, and so we're hoping you can keep on doing that and the into the time as this goes on. Do we have a quorum yet? Okay, so we'll call the meeting to order. We have two items today on the agenda. One is a presentation by the Minnesota Medical Association, and they're going to go for 12 or 15 minutes, and we're not going to do a lot of dialogue. I think it's going to be more, unless you have a shorter time, we can ask questions. And then the bulk of our time, which seems to have drawn some interest, we'll be talking about health costs in Minnesota by people we hire to do that. So without further ado, welcome to the committee, and you have a presentation to give us. You have handouts, is that right?
Should be in your packets.
And they look like...
Probably, Mr. Chair, which similar to the slideshow that we'll be watching.
Okay, thanks. And see, we have boxes of material today, so we have to carve our way through. So it's just a white... go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Eric Dick, and I'm the manager of State Legislative Affairs for the Minnesota Medical Association. I'm thrilled that there are so many people who are interested in the MMA. That's fabulous. Pardon?
They're all here to hear your presentation.
That's great.
Heard you're coming.
I'm joined at the table by Janet Silversmith, who is the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Minnesota Medical Association. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for the opportunity to share with you a little bit of information about the MMA, about our members and our work on comprehensive health care reform. In particular, today we'll briefly share with you a short primer on physicians in Minnesota, the MMA's substantial and historic work on health care reform, including public health promotion, payment reform, and delivery system innovation. And finally, we'll speak to some of the opportunities and challenges that face all of us, patients, providers, physicians, and policymakers. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn things over to Janet Silversmith.
Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Janet Silversmith with the MMA, and we do appreciate the chance to be here to provide an overview of the MMA and to talk about specific opportunities and some challenges as well. What I'd first like to do for those who may not be as familiar with the MMA is just to refresh you with the MMA and kind of a profile of the practicing physicians in the state of Minnesota. The MMA has a 158-year tradition and history of work in the state. We actually preceded Minnesota statehood, so we've been around for a long time trying to improve the health of Minnesotans and to improve the practice of medicine in the state. We have approximately 11,000 members representing all specialties and in all geographic areas of the state. Our mission is to provide advocacy, information, education, and leadership for physicians and on behalf of their patients. With respect to today's hearing, we have two specific strategic goals that I think are relevant and that I think are shared among you, and those are to have Minnesotans be the healthiest in the nation, to have a healthy and productive workforce, and to make Minnesota the best place to practice medicine so that we are continuing to be a world-class place where healthcare is delivered and that we continue to recruit talented and skilled medical professionals to the state of Minnesota. So with that, I also want to provide a few more facts about physicians. The Board of Medical Practices licensed physicians. There are about 19,600 licensed physicians in the state. Not all of those actively practice. Some of them carry licenses across multiple states. Some of them work in academia or in industry. So it's closer to about 15,000 or so physicians who are actively practicing in the state of Minnesota. We rank 13th in the nation when you look at the number of actively practicing physicians per 100,000 population. Our rank is slightly higher. We rank 11th in the country if you look at the number of primary care physicians per 100,000 population. Not unlike other professions, there are concerns about the aging workforce and whether we have capacity sufficiently to serve an aging and growing population. 20% of all Minnesota physicians are over the age of 60, so it is something that we believe we need to keep an eye on. Just a quick scan. This is a graphic. It's often called the training pipeline. If you look at how long it takes physicians to who start their education and then emerge at the end of the pipeline, it takes an average or a minimum of 11 years and up to 15 years for physicians to complete their training. Minnesota graduates approximately 280 new physicians every year, split between the two medical schools at the University of Minnesota and Mayo Medical School. And at any given time, there's about 2,200 medical residents who are in training in the state in a variety of specialties and in both hospitals and clinics in all throughout the state. The organization of medical care is actually quite different in Minnesota compared to most other states, which is important, I think, to think about as you look at how policy and changes may affect the organization of care. In most other states, physicians practice in relatively small groups, kind of the onesie-twosie kind of practices. That's really not the tradition in case here in Minnesota. We have a long history of group practice and of multi-specialty group practices in Minnesota. This graphic shows the distribution of Minnesota physicians by the size of their primary clinic site. About 30% of all physicians in the state work in groups under the size of 50 FTE physicians, meaning more than about 70% of all physicians work in clinics that are larger than 50. So it's quite, they're quite large in the way that they're organized. Healthcare is obviously a significant economic industry in the state, and physician practices play a significant role in that as well. The MMA recently partnered with the American Medical Association to commission a study that was recently conducted or finalized by the Lewin Group to look at the economic impact of office-based physicians. So if we exclude those in academia and who work exclusively in hospitals, to look at what they bring in terms of the economy. And the results here that have just been released is that physicians provide both direct and indirect output, if you will, in terms of sales revenue of more than $16 billion a year. The average physician supports 5.8 jobs, including her own, and more than $12 billion in wages and benefits to the state of Minnesota. Before I talk about some of our specific issues and opportunities, I wanted to remind some of you and to introduce those of you who may be new to MMA's commitment to healthcare reform. The MMA actually helped put healthcare reform back on the state's public policy agenda with the publication in 2005 of our report, The Physician's Plan for a Healthy Minnesota. We later partnered across the industry to form the Healthy Minnesota Partnership to try to move healthcare reform forward. Our work culminated in legislation in 2007, which ultimately ended in the formation of the Governor's Transformation Task Force. And central to our proposal and our belief about healthcare reform is that you have to take a comprehensive view and look at all of the factors that affect health and affect the delivery of care. Like our 2005 report and two of our strategic goals that I previously shared in terms of increasing and creating the healthiest population in the state and making Minnesota the best place to practice medicine, there are a variety of strategies that we believe that not only the private sector but the legislature needs to pay attention to in reforming health. In particular, it's investing in public health to address prevention and health promotion. It's assuring affordable coverage for all, making sure that the delivery of care is high quality, safe, and efficient, that payment is appropriate and provides the right incentives for the delivery of care, and finally, that we create an environment and culture in our state that supports care, medical education, and research. We certainly spend a lot of time in this committee and elsewhere talking about the clinical care, in other words, how physicians, nurses, hospitals, nursing facilities, and others impact and influence the health of Minnesotans. We certainly want to address those, but also remind you of the broader context in which individuals are healthy or work to attain health. work by the University of Wisconsin and also by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have looked at the specific determinants of an individual's or a population's health, which looked that actually 40% of an individual's health is actually addressed by social and economic factors such as their educational attainment, their income levels, and their employment. Healthy behaviors and the decisions that individuals make are responsible for approximately 30% of the determinants of a patient's health. Their use of alcohol and tobacco, exercise and diet. Clinical care is actually a smaller proportion at only 20%. And finally, the environment in which we live in terms of air and water quality is about 10%. We would certainly ask that you work with us to leverage those other determinants of health so that we can collectively work to improve the health of all Minnesotans. In particular, our support is unwavering in preserving the Freedom to Breathe Act to make sure that people are kept away from the harmful effects of tobacco. And we also think there are opportunities to further reduce Minnesotans' access to tobacco and alcohol. Another strategy for achieving health for all Minnesotans is obviously assuring coverage. The MMA supports universal coverage and coverage for all. Obviously, a lot of this work has moved to the federal level with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, but we do support an individual mandate. We believe that it is the most effective and fair way to accomplish coverage for all individuals. This graphic simply shows the current distribution of the sources of coverage for all Minnesotans.
Ms. Silverman, you're doing great. You got about 5 minutes, just so you know.
Right,
so,
thanks. We believe there's some specific opportunities for coverage. We would urge the legislature to move to implement the individual or the insurance exchange. We believe a first step is actually the adoption of the governing structure for the exchange. And we also look forward to reforming the Minnesota Care Program once the subsidies are in place in 2014, at which time we believe that the need for the provider tax is diminished when subsidies from the federal government are finally in place. There are a variety of delivery system reform changes. I've listed in the handout, and I won't talk about them, some of the private industry activities that are currently occurring to actually improve care through Minnesota Community Measurement, the Alliance for Patient Safety, Credentialing, and Administrative Uniformity. In terms of some specific opportunities, on the next slide, we actually continue to urge the legislature to support and invest in the healthcare home auto, which we believe is still very much in its infancy and needs additional time to be developed. Payments have actually only recently begun to flow, so we don't think the full effects of those models are there. And later this spring and summer, we hope to bring the Medicare population into the healthcare homes, which we believe is significant and a significant opportunity. Finally, I'll talk a little bit about payment reform. We think there are three specific features about payment reform that need to be addressed. One is access and the financial viability of clinics, the lack of underfunding in the program by the state in terms of the state paying its fair share, and finally, payment that rewards value. I'm going to move forward quickly to talking a little bit about how payments in the public programs are set. From a fee-for-service side, the Minnesota Department of Human Services recently updated its methodology. Unfortunately, it was 4 years late. It was due in 2007, but they have finally implemented it in 2011. This is a budget-neutral change, so it means that dollars were shifted from some services, generally procedure services, and towards office visits or primary care services. Three conversion factors or dollars have been set to determine how payments are actually made. We would urge the legislature, as you look at any necessary changes to payment rates, to focus on conversion factors moving forward as opposed to looking specifically at services or specialties of providers. The next graphic shows you an example for two office visit codes, the impact of this shift. There's one office visit code and a second code on your left. They differ based on time. The far left bars are where Minnesota was in 2010. The green bar represents where they are as a result of the new change, which is a shift, taking dollars away from some. The black bar is the 2008 median commercial or private sector payment rate for those services, and the gap between the green and the black still represents the underfunding or the cost shift that exists between the private programs and the state. The next slide is actually another way to look at this. This graphic shows the trends, the cumulative percentage change in trends in inflation, which is the yellow line. The blue line is the Medicare payment rates as a comparison, and the red line, which then splits to also show the lighter blue, shows fee-for-service Medicaid. The split at the end shows how there are recent cuts in specialty provider rates compared to primary care rates. what you will see is the growing gap. Since 2000, there has been no across-the-board increase or investment in the physician fee schedule, meaning that in real dollars, there has been a cut every year in the rates paid to physicians and other providers paid by the fee schedule. And the gap in the inflation rate in terms of the office costs and the others that providers face continues to increase, as shown by that differential. Another way to think about this, and certainly given today's conversation, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention managed care payment rates. This is a graph showing the cumulative percentage change in payments made by the Department of Human Services to the managed care plans from 1998 to 2008. There are a variety of factors that drive the increase in this trend line, including new enrollees and increased in utilization. And some of that growth certainly makes sense, but when we look at the discrepancy between the rate increase in the previous slide, which is essentially a flat line in physician fees, we find it pretty striking. It's particularly striking since one of the assumptions that is built into the managed care rates is an assumption that there's actually an investment in the surpluses that the health plans retain, which is again striking when physicians are often not covering their costs and in fact are in real dollars having their rates cut every year. The report recently released by the Department of Human Services on Friday that shows how managed care plans are paying providers, we have not yet had a chance to fully review, but it confirms some of our previous suspicions, which is that the increases that you see in this line, in the trend line, are not necessarily due to increases in rates paid to providers. Most plans have reported that they pay below 110% of the state fee schedule, and any increases that they may pass on to the providers are only linked to changes in the fee schedule, which again we know has not changed since 2000. Finally, there are a variety of payment models that we know are getting a lot of discussion, from fee-for-service to baskets of care, bundles, episode care, total cost of care. We provide 5 common models and some definitions, and we also provided you with an article that further reviews some of those and talks about some of the pros and cons associated with them. What we would ask you to think about is that, and our position is that there's really no singular payment model that we believe will support the complexity of the way that care is delivered and the complexity of the types of care that is delivered throughout the state of Minnesota. And would ask that you continue to support flexibility and innovation in payment models. And finally, I will just mention kind of the environmental support for healthcare in the state of Minnesota. I know there's been a lot of discussion and interest in the topic of tort reform. As an organization, the MMA does support caps on non-economic damages as a way to improve risk and premium predictability. In terms of environmental supports, we also feel pretty strongly about the need to keep medical education affordable. This graphic shows you that the current debt of medical school graduates exceeds the national average and is a concern to us as we continue to recruit physicians and keep physicians in Minnesota. And finally, from a business tax perspective, we believe that the provider tax continues to be a strong negative for physicians and potential physicians looking to move to Minnesota, and look forward to 2014 when we believe there's a chance to change and eliminate the provider tax. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you covering. This is some good material. Maybe when we're going to do is thank you for coming. Maybe when you do our kind of group thing, one of the two of you can sit there and be available for questions. Maybe if the department wants to come now. We're going to have 3 presentations now, members, during which I think we'll take no questions, and at the end we'll have kind of, a wide-ranging discussion. Ms. Pete or whoever else is coming down from the department. She was kind of modest, but Ms. Silverman, this is your article, right? That it was in the Minnesota about the in the Minnesota Medicine article about the. It's not. Okay. Anyway, so look at that. That's interesting. Okay. Never mind. Okay. Oh, it is a different. Never mind then. I also in your packets. Yeah, have a chair. Also in your packet, you'll see 3 articles that are from me. Just to kind of help, and I do want to point out that we're at capacity of the room, so we have a sellout crowd here. Unfortunately, we didn't sell any tickets, so we didn't. It's a new fiscally neutral event, but you're part of history, and we're also part of. I believe this would be the most handouts we've ever had in any committee I've ever been on, counting the ones that have come from my 3 little ones here. Yeah, I do feel special. There's 3 articles here. One is. About came from the Ms. Cullen from Care Providers. And there's a sentence here I liked especially. It says about managed care plans that they should have to prove their value as well. Everything should have to prove their value these days, and that's just wasn't a dig. It was just pointing out. Mayo had an article about that, and there's a good value there, I think, if we use it correctly. And then there's an article out of New York Times, and they talk about what's going across the country. And I'm hoping we can avoid every example that they've given here in Minnesota. That's my goal. And so we'll look at that and know what we don't want to do. And we have to do some minutes. Who hasn't done minutes yet this year? I think Repson Hayden maybe has, but he gets two if he did it once. He'd like to move the minutes. Any discussion about those? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Repson Hayden. We're going to have three presentations now for nominally 10 minutes each, more or less, and time will go as it goes, from the department, from Mr. Finewalks, and then from the health plans. And if you can just absorb your questions and get ready for a discussion at the end, we're then going to have a kind of open discussion about the topic. So welcome to the committee. We've already been here once talking about this to a little extent, so but welcome back. I know you have a handout, and thanks for being part of our discussion today. Ms. Bead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Karen Peed. I'm not sure if I'm talking in
the microphone.
Oh, yeah,
get closer. Yeah.
I'm the Director for Managed Care Purchasing and Payment Policy at the Department of Human Services. I was asked to provide some background to the committee on what kinds of information is provided by DHS to the managed care organizations, what information they provide to the department, and also to briefly do an overview of our rate setting process. The Department of Human Services provides information to health plans about their enrollees. This is specific information about age, gender, their master index number that identifies them in our system, information, there's some background information on languages spoken in the home other than English, and a variety of other information. Associated with that is information about the rate that we are paying to the health plan for each individual, and information about the health risk of the managed care organization's enrollees. Each person comes with a different set of health conditions, and to the extent that we have history for the health plan or for the individual member, that information is also provided to the managed care organizations. We provide information about our provider system because we require them to report their data about services using the same way of enumerating providers that we use, rather than doing a crosswalk with their systems. And so that allows us to also provide them with information that needs to be tracked across managed care organizations. For example, we're in the process of working through tracking the legislative requirement that PCA hours be limited and that no PCA be allowed to work, for example, more than 24 hours in a day. And so in order to do that, we need to be able to track an individual PCA provider from fee-for-service and across any of the many health plans that we contract with, so that we can see that no individual PCA has exceeded their hours. Information provided to DHS. The managed care organizations provide a wide variety of information. This is not an exhaustive list. It's just a set of samples. The first is detailed claim-specific encounter data. And beginning in this year's contracts, we will be receiving payment data on those encounters. They report information about third-party liability and other collections. That's so that if to the extent that they are collecting information from other entities, we are not paying for that in our rates. They give us information about their progress toward meeting incentives and withholds, reports on grievances and appeals filed by their members, reports on denials, termination, reductions of services, quality reports, and performance improvement projects. They give us information on child and teen checkups. Not that we wouldn't catch that in the encounter data. We do get that information through the encounters. But this is information that is needed to be shared with counties, and so they provide additional real-time information so that the data can be shared with counties for follow-up in an effective time frame. We need to review any documents that they're providing to our enrollees, and so those are submitted to the department. We get information on provider networks and care systems, and this includes information on changes. The reason for this is that we believe that the department has a right to know what it is that we're buying and the extent to if the network is changing. We need to be aware of the changes and whether they are still able to provide sufficient access to the people that they are contracted to serve. This would also be information about additional providers, and this is provided on a schedule throughout the year. For Minnesota Senior Health Options, they're required to do an annual care systems audit. Any changes to their care and case management systems, any changes to single source contracts. So if a health plan, for instance, contracts with a pharmacy vendor, that pharmacy vendor will provide a formulary and a variety of ways of managing those services. If that changes, we require to be notified because there will be changes for the enrollee. For 2010, they provided aggregate payment information. I should say, this slide is misleading. In 2010, they provided aggregate payment information for 2009. They also give us reports of fraud or abuse on the part of providers and a whole array of other information. Rate setting. Are you going to... I'm sorry.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if you'll tell me when I'm under 5 minutes, I'd appreciate it.
I think you're doing pretty well.
Okay. Rates are a projection based on managed care organization experience, actual cost trends, and anticipated cost trends. So we look back at a previous period to see what was actually spent. And rather than doing a single year, when we had a single year as our base rate, we found that our rates followed behind either up or down, sort of in lockstep. And by using a three-year period as a base, we managed to smooth out some of the curves in that system. It is, we take a look at what the average cost was for providing benefits for administration, and we establish a base rate. Then we make changes based on changes usually that the legislature has made. If there are increases or decreases in payments for services, if there are additional benefits that the legislature has added or that the department has made a decision for policy reasons to add to the managed care contract, if there are changes in eligibility so that people are moving, for instance, from General Assistance Medical Care to Minnesota Care, all of that would have to be factored into the rates. And that change is made on the base at the end. We trend those forward to develop the new rates. So again, this is where we come into the part where there's an anticipated cost trend, and if we expect trends to go up, we'd be having an increase in rates. If we see that the trend is going down over time in combination with payment changes, then there would be a decrease in the rates. And over time, the rate has tended to increase for the PMAP population, the prepaid medical assistance family and children contract. This year, the rates went down. And the other thing that we do is to avoid too much self-referencing information. Instead of only looking at managed care experience, we also like to have a non-managed care baseline, and we look at Medicare and Medicaid trends either on fee-for-service or in other states that are also doing managed care. And typically we would blend that trend with the actual cost experience. It usually has the effect of a slight decrease in the trend. Rates need to reflect the population that's covered in the contract, regional cost differences, anticipated cost of services, and other required duties. Other required duties would be quality activities that the health plans have to provide, administrative activities, interpreter services, a whole range of services that they are required by contract to provide. These, as far as the costs go, they vary from population to population. It is more costly to provide care to seniors than it is to families and children. Probably more costly to provide care to MA families and children generally has been our experience than the Minnesota Care families and children. So it has to reflect each of those rate groups. There are regional cost differences between the metro and differences between various parts of the state of Minnesota. The rates need to reflect, as I said before, the anticipated cost of services and their other duties. And then risk-based contracts must also include some provision for reserves. It is important to note that the health plans take 100% of the risk on this population. So having established a set of rates to serve the populations that we have under contract, the health plans take the risk for that. If the rates are too low, they still have to provide all of the medically necessary services that are covered under the contract, and to the extent that they have reserves, they would be expected to fund those services out of the reserves. And that's the reason for the contribution. It sometimes is referred to contribution to margin or contribution to reserves. Another quick topic that I thought I would like to discuss is actuarial soundness. In order for us to get participation from the federal government for any of the programs that we do get participation for, and this would be medical assistance and most parts of Minnesota care, the rates have to be determined to be actuarially sound. This means the sort of functional definition is that they need to be sufficient to cover anticipated claims cost and other contractual obligations. I mentioned those before, quality activities, administrative activities, license fees and taxes that the MCO is required to pay. They need to cover service delivery. They need to cover, the other thing is that we have certification requirements, as mentioned before, including a contribution to reserve for risk-based contracts. These certifications are performed by qualified actuaries, and the definition for actuarial soundness is provided by the National Organization for Actuaries.
I think that's pretty good, isn't it?
Okay.
Yeah. Are you here to be support, or do you have something to say, Mr. Lane? Oh, yeah. Oh, are you presenting?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Lights. I certainly am here to support Ms. Pete in her work, and she does it well. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. I just want to say a few comments.
Please do.
First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for holding the hearing today. These are important issues that you're discussing here. They're important ones because the state is facing a very large deficit in the coming years. I don't have to tell anyone around the committee table that it's a crucial time, and it's important that we know whether the dollars that we're investing in healthcare are being used prudently and wisely. And I know as the administration has come in, as Commissioner Jessen has come in at the Department of Human Services, these are questions that we're starting to ask and wanting to ask, and appreciate sort of the community interest and effort to get as much information as possible to help us do our jobs better, to ensure that we're working with state resources as well as we possibly can. We feel we do have an obligation to get the best possible services for the dollars that we invest. We like every purchaser, large purchaser of healthcare, have one goal in mind, our largest goal, which is to ensure that our clients get the services that they need to live as productive and successful lives as they possibly can, and to do that in a cost-efficient and effective way. And we strive to do that as a purchaser every day. As the discussion evolves, Mr. Chair, moving forward, you'll, I think, be hearing from us on a variety of issues. I think we want to work with you and members of the committee on issues of transparency, of reporting, and ultimately of how we can do purchasing the best way we possibly can in the state. So I think we're looking internally right now to see whether there's additional information we can provide to the market and to interested parties. We may need additional information. You may be hearing from us on that soon as well. Underneath that, we're looking at moving forward as we move into our next contracting process, how we can improve our processes. We believe they're very solid processes now, but we want to continually improve them and make them as best as they can possibly be. And Mr. Chair, finally, I recognize that you're going to be doing, a hearing on this a little bit later in the week on accountable care organizations, but we really see that as going hand in glove with how we do any contracting or purchasing that we do, ensuring that the delivery system and the financial incentives for providers are aligned as well with however we choose to finance care above that. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity.
And we'll call you back for the panel. Maybe if Mr. Feinwax wants to come. I know some people have questions, but if we... They're not listening. So if members are late, we're not going to do questions till the end. And so if you're just painfully having to ask a question, I don't want you to burst. But so we'll never get to the witnesses. Mr. Feinwax, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Dave Feinwax.
Do you have any handouts?
I believe they were distributed, I hope.
Yeah, so if the pages have the handouts, but you can.
I will.
And so we're if you can kind of take 10, 12 minutes to kind of make your main point, and then we're going to have a dialogue at the end. And
I will tell you, I'm sorry, I only made 25 copies of my material, which I made at my own expense, and if I'd known what the MMA said, that so many people were interested in the MMA, I would have made more copies. The material that you're going to receive from me largely consists of publicly available information, and I'm going to ask you to consider and leave you with some provocative questions today. Because what I'm going to ask you to consider is this. Everyone agrees that our healthcare system is problematic, and if not broken. And one of the key things is you can't fix something unless you know how it works. So we need to know how the system works, and one of the best ways of gaining some insight into how our system works is through our publicly run and funded programs so that we have some understanding. I'm going to suggest to you that you and we don't actually know how our system works. There's a lot of information that's missing in action. The actual operation of these programs is a mystery to us. We have outsourced them some years ago to managed care organizations, or MCOs, and while there are lots and lots of reports, nobody's going to dispute that, the usefulness of those reports and the kind of data we have are really not the kind we need so that we can determine where our money's going, if we're actually getting any value for our money, and whether or not there's some savings that can result. Now, there's something currently very wrong here. And one of the first things I'm going to ask you to consider is on January 27th, there was an article by the Star and Tribune which talked about some new proposals for budget solutions. And while we can debate profitability of health plans and how it's calculated, that's not what I want to get into at this point. What I want to direct your attention to is in the Star and Tribune article, which they researched based on material I assume that was given to them by our friends at the plans, there's a statement that the profitability on commercial business in Minnesota is 1.6%, and the profitability on your state-run programs, and again, I don't agree with the magnitude, but I want you to look at the ratio, is 4.1%. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, how is it possible that managing the Medicaid and public program population can be 2.5 or 3 times more profitable than running commercially insured healthy people in commercial insurance programs? And secondly, why, if you choose, would you choose to run your programs by hiring people who make 2.5 or 3 times more profit administering your business than they do running their own? And these are questions that are critical questions, and they're a beginning point for our discussion. Also in your material, you will find an article from the Wall Street Journal that reaffirms, and this article was published on December 29th, that reaffirms that basically the operation of Medicaid plans like ours in Minnesota, and this is not unique to Minnesota, is the most profitable area of business for these organizations. In fact, the Wall Street Journal says it's one of their few bright spots, according to the executive vice president of one of the largest insurers, United Health. It is a significant long-term growth opportunity. It's where they make all their money. Given that the fact that we are their biggest customer and they're making all their money off of us, shouldn't we insist that our programs be run a little better, a little more sharply? And this is something else that I want you to consider. The other issue is, and this is also controversial, you've heard a statement that under these programs, the plans assume 100% of the risk. Now, that's a true statement. But what if the risk is zero? What are they assuming? Last year we introduced legislation, and in your material is a copy of two copies of a fiscal note, and I've blown up one part because it's the interesting part, but I've also given you the entire fiscal note because I think it's really important that you read it and take a look at it. And it basically said, we proposed last year, some health care providers and other groups, that there be a medical loss ratio. And if the loss ratio was violated, that money would forfeit back to the state. And the fiscal note, the analysis of this proposal was that the state would never make any money on this because even if there was such a forfeiture, the plans would bill the cost of the penalty back into their rates and recover it in subsequent years. Now, if that's the way the system runs, this is an enormous problem. And in fact, there is no risk in these programs. By the way, the state of Minnesota, in operating its programs, does actually hold its own risk. You are your own reinsurer, just as an ERISA employer is their own reinsurer. In fact, almost 70% of the healthcare market today involves entities that hold their own risk and use health plans as third-party administrators where no real risk is involved of any substance. So these are things that I'm going to ask you to consider, and which I, you know, would call the sort of myth of insurance. The other thing that we really need to address is there's no competitive bidding here. There's no competition in these programs. Every plan participates. During this hearing and in the weeks to come, you will hear the term aggregate data. It's aggregate data. It's the data of every plan that wants to participate, run through a statistical blender and given to you because they all participate. Now, the American way contemplates some competition, and in fact, competition is perfectly permissible in this arena. You don't have to negotiate with every plan. You don't have to set rates with each of them. You can, if you'll forgive the statement, squeeze them. And in fact, in 2006, Lewin actually published a report saying that if you're going to try to balance your state budget woes, don't squeeze them till they turn blue and die. Obviously, you know, I disagree with that view, but someplace between my view and the Lewin view is probably a prudent way to manage your programs, and we need to think about some competitive bidding and some kind of reining in of the costs. Now, you've heard a lot about actuarial soundness. I've also given you a copy of the GAO report, the General Accountability Report from last August. There are some real problems with the concept of actuarial soundness, not the least of which is the American Academy of Actuaries has stated in this report that they don't have an actuarial standard principle that deals with work done for CMS. They have some practice note guidelines, and it's unclear whether we're meeting even those guidelines. So there's some significant ambiguity in this area. The other thing that we don't know is, I believe that the state's actuary is Milliman. In all the time we've debated this, I don't recall anyone from Milliman being here. I have no idea, and I don't think anybody has any idea except for the plans, who their actuaries are, whether they are outside firms, whether they are internal actuaries, how this works, because the actuaries are likely the people who know what's going on and who produce this information and who would give some real meaningful insight into what's happening. So the issue of actuarial soundness is clearly kind of an open question, and it's not nearly as cut and dried as you may believe. The other thing is I will direct your attention in the report, because I know that you're very busy and nobody's going to read a 40-page report. You look at the top of page 8 and it will of the GAO report, and it will confirm to you what I'm telling you about the principles of actuarial soundness in the practice note. If you look at the bottom of page 18 for the conclusion, it will tell you that there is concern about the reliability and the validity of data which goes into Medicaid rate certification, and that there's some real questions about how it's calculating and what's going on. The other issue I want to draw your attention to is, again, we are not alone in this. There's a letter from the Wisconsin legislative auditor in your packet. Wisconsin has recently announced a full-blown complete audit of their programs. Like Minnesota, they've got a large number of people in managed care. They spend huge amounts of money, just as we do, and they've come to the conclusion costs are out of control. They're not quite sure what's happening, and they're going to do a full-blown audit. That is a great idea. Minnesota should embrace that idea, and Wisconsin, as our legislature, is under Republican control. Currently, we've really upped the stakes in this entire debate, because And we're now talking about the elderly, the disabled, blind. We're talking about some of our most vulnerable populations. And we're talking about moving them into these programs, into these methodologies that we really don't understand. And before we disadvantage these citizens, these people that we have all committed to take care of, shouldn't we explore every available option? Shouldn't we look at what else could be done to achieve savings? And even if they weren't being moved into these mechanisms, apparently against their will, shouldn't we be doing this anyway? Because there could be some huge budget savings to be obtained here. What if we're paying a considerable commission rate for the operation of these programs? We don't know it. People are now interested in transparency and accountability. We can't solve our budget situation without it. We've got to understand how these programs work. The public expectation is that we're going to get to the bottom of this. And so you're going to see programs coming forward in the next few weeks to address these kinds of things. And everyone will be here to provide whatever assistance they can and to bring these matters to your attention. And as always, I appreciate the opportunity to speak. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feinwalk. We're not going to. Thank you. we don't usually applaud here, so. But thank you. So the plans want to come down, Ms. Wooster? You by yourself? Okay, well, you can bring your friend along. And so 10 or 12 minutes, and we're going to have a dialogue here, so I want you to be able to cover your material. And we're. I just also want to say something while people are moving around a little bit. My interest in having this hearing. People can be quiet, it would be good. Is to simply find out what the truth is. I don't have a side. I'm just an agnostic on this matter, and so I'm giving everybody a chance to state their points. The dialogue, I think, at the end will be interesting, and so I'm interested to hear what you have to say, too. So, Ms. Wooster, thanks for coming, and Mr. Bartsch, go ahead. And you have a handout, do you?
There's a packet.
And it's... We have the big box of stuff, which is...
I have the big box.
Thank you for that. We like data. So we've announced we like information, so I want to commend the... We have a box full of information, which people can read tonight or sometime. And you're going to go through this colored one now? Okay. So thanks. Go ahead. Thanks.
So good afternoon, Chairman Abler and members of the committee, and we really appreciate...
Oh, can you get closer to the mic? We want to hear what you have to say.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Abler and members of the committee. I am here today to represent the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and Jeff Bartsch is here with me. Jeff is the Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations for Medica, and I am the Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Marketing at UCARE. My name is Gita Wooster. And part of the reason I am the representative here for the health plans is that UCARE serves only individuals on state and federal public programs. Today we serve a little over 200,000 individuals. But I also was around in 1984 when the demonstration project started to serve the Medicaid managed care program as a pilot. So I saw the lack of access to health care services that was occurring in the community, and I have some grounding on that the good old days were not necessarily very good for access for individuals or quality of care. Sitting here today, I want to be as open and straightforward with you as possible. We get that there's questions being asked. We get that the state and federal health care programs are clearly needing to show their value. They're under intense scrutiny to look at how the dollars are being spent. And we understand that you want and deserve to see the value. I think I would question whether or not there, for people to say there's been no review or analysis of some of the value that the programs have brought, but clearly it hasn't been done in a broad, comprehensive manner and packaged together. So that's a fair statement to say that something like that needs to happen. I'm going to talk just a little bit in the short time about the enrollment, the payments, where the money goes from our perspective, oversight and accountability. and the value, but I hope you are going to be interested in inviting us back to talk more about the value, because in 10 to 12 minutes, it's impossible to talk about that in any kind of comprehensive way. And then we have some recommendations that we support for going forward that I hope you're interested in hearing. So just as we talk about the payments to health plans, I think it's important to understand a couple of buckets here. There's $6.7 billion spent on Medicaid in 2009, but $4.7 billion of that was paid in fee-for-service, and $2 billion to the health plans. And in Minnesota Care, it's a little more focused on the money that's paid to health plans versus fee-for-service, because it's really just the individuals as they first become eligible before they are available to go into the plans. This slide shows you the total enrollment by category, but there's 554,000 individuals that are covered under the various programs, and this number includes those individuals that are in county-based purchasing, as well as in the health plans that are part of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. There's three major buckets about how the money is spent when it comes in the door and goes out. There's payment for medical and hospital expenses, there's administrative expenses, and then there's what we call the contributions to reserves. And Karen Peed talked earlier about the report that was just released on provider payments. And that was done by aggregate payments, not by each individual provider specifically that was paid. But this just gives you a breakdown of what that report shows about where the dollars were paid by different programs. We are capped by legislation at 6.6% for administrative costs, and that was done in 2008. And as a comparison to some other states looking at Medicaid managed care programs, they vary between 8.8% and some up to 26%. And there's some states that are shown on here on the slide for you. The accounting rules that we must follow put the disease management programs that we provide at the health plans into the administrative costs. And obviously that's where we have a lot of opportunity for providing better outcomes and care coordination for the individuals that we serve. The disease management programs are targeted. They clearly have shown savings. And if I look at data from UCARE, there's two programs I just wanted to highlight. We have a diabetes program that has been tracked over several years, but in a two-year period, we reduced hospital utilization by 11%. And for members in a high-intensity congestive heart failure program, we had 60% fewer admissions than the non-program members. Those are very positive results, and those are some of the outcomes. They have cost savings, and they have health outcomes when those programs are operating effectively. Questions have been asked about health plan reserves, and we just thought taking a minute on this. In the rate setting process, the state does look at targets for health plan contribution to reserves. I know some folks call it profits. Those that look at the reserves and say, well, plans are at 2.5 times what the requirement is, I just want to give you an example of one health plan. We were at the end of 2009, and that's the last year we have an audited result, 462% of the authorized control level. And that's how it's presented. The 200% level would mean that the Department of Health and Commerce would be getting involved in looking at how we were operating. So 200% means below that, we're not financially viable from the way the state would look at the health plans. But the other way I look at this is that is 2.1 months of expenses that we pay for all services. And when you think about how businesses operate, having 2.1 months of expenses sitting in the bank is not an exorbitant amount of money for us to have. And actually, a couple of other figures, and I can give are specifically, there's $50 million that the state has in withholds to our particular plan right now. Every June, they delay how they pay the plans for one full month. The money for June comes in July. And this past October and November, there were two-week delays in when the plans were paid, so that cash flow has been utilized by the state as well. The slide here And there's different ways you can cut and slice it, but this is done through 2000 to 2009. It's a 10-year average of gains and losses, and it comes to a 0.91%. And clearly, when you look at this chart, there were years that the payment to the plans went below. Because of the way that the state does pay, there are going to be ups and downs in how this process works, because you are projecting what you believe will happen, and obviously sometimes those projections are not going to match exactly what occurs in the health plan environment. Minnesota State Agency Oversight. And the previous speaker, Mr. Feinwalk, acknowledged that there is a lot of reporting and oversight that goes on. The Department of Health looks at our financial requirements for licensure. Department of Human Services looks at compliance with contractual and financial terms. And one of the items in your packet is the contract that the health plans have in place with the Department of Human Services. And the Department of Commerce looks at our financial monitoring and auditing on behalf of the Health Department. And then for programs that are for individuals with Medicare and Medicaid, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid get involved. Health plans are subject to a lot of financial and quality audits, and we file hundreds of reports. Chairman Abler and members of the committee, we have a list of all of those reports in your packet. I don't know if there's one right place to bring this up. If we are not submitting or sharing information is what your questions are regarding, we are open to submitting different information, but I think as you'll see as we go through this, some of it may be that the information is available, but it's not readily available. It's not a point and click to a particular website to get all of the answers that to the questions that you have. Just have a slide in here. This is the website that the Department of Health has where you can see our 990 form. You can see the revenue, expenses, and net income. And you can see the financial examination and quality examination results right out there on the website. We're also required to file an annual statement with the Department of Commerce that's based on the National Association of Insurance Commissioners requirements, and that has additional financial information that's clearly broken down. Again, the problem may be that it's not easy to find in one place where all the information's available, but we stand ready here to help make that more accessible if that's what you're interested in achieving here. The true test, we believe, of accountability is the value that we bring. And although you asked us to come and talk today about dollars, I just want to make a step back for a minute and remember that what we believe we are providing in collaboration with the state is quality health care services to individuals on state public programs in this state. And that should be the core of where we keep our discussion going. We provide improved access to preventive and primary care. There's outreach and education activities. There's individualized care management services, and there's lower cost and services that are utilized as appropriate for individuals. I would be remiss if not showing this one example here. When we started to serve individuals on state public programs, dental access was horrible in greater Minnesota. And we partnered with the Department of Dentistry at the University of Minnesota to develop a mobile dental clinic that drives around the state to increase access. It also increases the number of dentists that are available through the program. But there's transportation services that are available today that did not exist before the managed care programs got engaged. In 1989, in Ramsey County, you couldn't get in easily to an OBGYN provider. In North Minneapolis, if you wanted to see an orthopedist, you couldn't get into a provider. So there are some ways that health plans have been involved, and I could have an extensive list about access, but I just wanted to leave that point there. There's also some examples of research that has gone on Medicaid managed care. And again, we've heard that we haven't done enough in the state to go over the value that we've brought. Some of this research is very good in detail from other states. Some of it references some of the quality they believe is occurring right here in Minnesota. I want to end this. I hope I got time for my last slide. We're standing ready here to talk about improved accountability and transparency. If the state feels that more analysis is needed to explore an independent analysis of the outcomes, enrollee satisfaction, and costs for providing care through managed care to enrollees in the state, let's do it. But let's make sure we're comparing to fee-for-service, because it's important to see the differences in the outcomes there. If we need to push out more data that we already report, and I would urge us to look at what we are already reporting, let's do that. Maybe having all that information in one place would help. And then let's see what else you want us to report, because as you'll see in your packet, there's over 200 reports going on. Maybe some of them could be stopped and others created, but there's a lot of information going in. And then we're thinking that the state should consider having one centralized website repository for the health plan financial and performance information. And again, repeating, we want to make sure we're looking at quality and finances together and the member experience. We think that's important to keep those three together.
Well, thank you very much. Mr. Bartsch, do you want to say anything, or are you just there to look good? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't want to say anything and get in the way of a fine presentation.
Oh, no, I appreciate the content. With Brett, if you want to pull the chair down, and then if you want to stay there, and Mr. Vinewalks, and then the department, and at the MMA wants to come down. I'm really enjoying the good crowd we have today here, and if this is going to be the trend, I want to caution, though, tomorrow we're not meeting, so don't come. There's some governor giving a state of the state at the same time, and I'm sure our ratings would be better than his if we were doing this, but you'll want to pay attention to that. On Thursday, you want to come back on Thursday. We're going to do Department of Health, talk about some grants and county-based purchasing and medical homes, so that's pretty scintillating as well. Is there room for all of you? It looks like they're pretty good there. And is there room for Ms. Peed there? Okay. Anyway, so we're going to finish out the hour with questions. And so if members can keep their questions somewhat, within, not big statement questions, but the time is ours. And maybe there'll be a couple answers if it's appropriate from the panel. Then we'll move on to the next question. I have Gottwald, Huntley, and Hamilton. So Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate this opportunity. We've been talking in the area of health care reform about some proposals. I won't mention any in specific, but some we've actually talked about bipartisanly, where it would have been very helpful for us, and this is a question that I'll pitch to both the Department of Human Services and to the health plans. We have asked for claims-level data so we could actually model new ways of doing things, new ways of providing coverage, so we could be absolutely or as close to possibly accurate as we're modeling these new approaches. And one thing we've asked for is, not by name, but claims-level data. Do we have claims-level data that the Department of Human Services could report to us? And we've typically been told no. We're spending, for example, in Minnesota Care, approximately $500, $600 per member per month. We don't have the claims level data. The health plans have it. When I talk to the health plans tell me we give that data to the Department of Human Services. They may not be able to process it. The frustration for me as a policymaker and somebody, very interested in reform and accurate modeling of reform is, can we get the data or can't we? And if it's there and we're not able to access it, what can we do to get at it? Because right now, to a certain extent, it's standing in the way of a real open, transparent conversation about where there might be opportunities to save money, improve care delivery, even where what kind of care delivery is resulting in the most expenditure right now under these public programs in managed care. So I do that without accusing anybody, but with a serious question about where is this data and how can we get at it?
I don't know, Ms. Peed, Ms. Wooster, Mr. Vinewalks, kind of pull up to the microphone, and there's room for, Ms. Peed, why don't you want to go, or Ms. Wooster, you want to go first?
We are submitting encounter data starting this year. It has the cost that we're paying, or the payment that we're making on each service attached to it. Previously, that was not in place. But just before I turn it over to Karen Peed, I think at times people say, well, gee, you've got it, can't you just lump it together and give us what you're asking for? There isn't always consistency to how everybody submits their data to the plans, and then the plans sending it off. So, for example, as the latest report was put together, our plan initially thought about putting in a stay for a hospital admission, and other plans did per day. Well, you got to make sure you're comparing apples and apples and not apples and oranges when you do this. So sometimes it takes a little longer to go through and make sure you're doing the right comparison.
Ms. Pede.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's correct that we have not had the data with the payment information attached at the claims level. We do have claims and utilization information, but until this year, we won't have collected the data with the payment attached.
Mr. Feinlock.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, if it's difficult for legislators to get the information, imagine what it's like on the civilian end of that activity. And I would also note that recently you've now received a report about some claims data. And let me just read to you something from the summary. It's important to note that this doesn't include any managed care organization administrative dollars or discussion of managed care organization surpluses. That's where the action is. That's the stuff you need to know to do your budget balancing work.
Representative Gottwald, follow up. Are you, is that okay?
I'm sure there's others who have questions, okay. Mr. Chair, but I, you know, this is an area that's been, we've been trying to crowbar this information for a while, and I, with all due respect to, you know, inconsistencies and not having particular levels of data reported, these are our tax dollars, and we want to use them to cover people, to take care of people in need, and we want to think about new and better ways. And if we can confirm that the way we're doing it is the best way in the world and we're saving a ton of money and delivering great outcomes, fabulous. Let's confirm that. And if there are better ways of doing it, we want to have the data so we can do our work. And it's been, frankly, very frustrating to me, and I think to others on both sides of the aisle, that we haven't had the data with which to do that. So I'm glad to hear we're finally beginning to get it, but as Mr. Feinwachs, I think, pointed out, there's still more we need, and we need transparency.
Thanks. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm always interested in financial incentives that various groups have, but before we get to that, I want to thank you for the putting all the loggers and paper plants in my part of the state to work 24 hours a day.
This is a jobs committee, Representative Huntley.
But I have a question for Ms. Pede. On your slide 5, which is the one on rate setting, is each managed care organization rate setting done separately based on what their record is? If you're looking for the 3-year average and projecting into the future, is that done separately for each individual managed care organization?
Ms. Pede.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, the rates are set across the system, so we take all the expenditures, roll them up across the state, and then rates are created for each health plan that would vary based on their enrollment, where they do business, you know, their proportion of people in various age groups. So the rates are set in aggregate. They're adjusted to reflect where plans have contracts, and in when we make a rate offer, essentially we give we say, if you had the same enrollment that you had last fiscal year, this is how the rates would work out for you, and then they have to evaluate that in terms of their current and expected enrollment. So it does, they're set in aggregate, but it does vary depending on where they do business and who they have enrolled in their plan.
Representative,
so Mr. Chairman and Ms. Pede, so that you set those for all the 4 or 5 plans, and they all then are going to get the same increase if they have the same number of enrollees.
Ms. Pete.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, no. Again, it depends on age, gender, whether I'm in St. Cloud or Duluth or Yellow Medicine County. All, there are variations in the rates based on geography. So in terms of a comparison, what we can give them is information about a past period of time, and they make the comparison from for that enrollment under the old rates and that same enrollment under the new rates.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, and you know, last week you heard from Dr. Wood, who said that at least 10% of what we do in healthcare is wasted and shouldn't have been done. And most other people say that about 30% is the correct number. My question is to the members here, where is the incentive to get rid of that 10% waste or that 30% waste? Because what that will result in is you getting less money next year. So how have we set the incentives in this program that would encourage people to greatly reduce spending and getting rid of waste?
I think that's the $3.1 billion question. That's a good question. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I believe my questions are down the same line of both Representative Huntley and Representative Gottwell. The first one, when we're talking about improving transparency and accountability, one, specifically to the health plans, I believe that currently we have the Department of Commerce who conducts financial investigations and also independent audits every year. So what I'm looking for in all the reporting, specifically, what isn't reported today that should be? And maybe that's a question to Mr. Feinwatz.
Mr. Feinwatz.
Chair, Representative, I believe that what you probably want to see is some kind of definitionally controlled by you reporting of true administrative expense relative to these activities, as well as looking at the issue of reserving money relative to the actual risk of administering the programs. And those kinds of reports, I believe, would be both valuable to you and extremely interesting.
Mr. Bartz, do you want to offer a comment?
Mr. Chairman, members, in regards to the administrative expense.
Oh, Mr. Bartz, we haven't heard who you really are. So.
My name is Jeff Bartz. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations for Medica. In regards to the information on administrative expenses, I think in the back of your packet you'll find the, I think they're legal documents that we produce every year from the Department of Health that show our medical expenses and administrative costs by product. So you'll see by each specific public program how much we're spending on medical expenses and then also how much we're spending on administrative costs. Now, that's not categorized. But we also have to produce for the Department of Health a summary of our administrative expenses, which is categorized by functional category. And Mr. Leitz could probably give you more detail on that. I think he developed that report some years ago at the Department of Health. But to this general question, that information is being reported along with there were questions about our surplus. We report our annual financial statements to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. You can download that information off the website and get everyone's full report. So to your question again, Representative Hamilton, that's really one of the questions we're hoping to get an answer to. We feel like we're producing a lot of information to a lot of different agencies and a lot of people. That's why you have a nice big packet of paper in front of you. We really would like to make sure that what we're producing for the state is the information that they and all of you would like to help manage the programs. If we can answer that question and then along the way maybe stop submitting the information in a manner that isn't helpful or confusing to people, that would be of great assistance as well, and we're happy to work with people to do that.
And just for the members, it's the interest of this chair that we could help that to happen by having, I think Ms. Wooster suggested, if we need other reports, then let's ask for those and quit asking for things where nobody reads. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for my second question, it's to the funding formulas, specifically to the rate settings. I believe this question would go to Ms. Peed. When you're talking about rate setting slide number 6, you have in there regional cost differences, and I'd like to understand that a little better. And I believe to Representative Huntley's point, or I'd like to make a point to Representative Huntley's statement as well. What I've noticed, whether it's been LGA calculations or nursing home funding calculations, or and it seems to go on, it appears that the low rate receivers or the individuals in the past that have done an excellent job controlling costs are typically the ones that get punished, if you will, when we design these funding formulas. And the individuals who, it appears to me, that the individuals who have been potentially wasteful or high cost are the ones that continue to get additional dollars. And I just want to point that out, and I feel that there's definitely a discrepancy there. So that's a statement. But again, to the specific question on the regional cost differences, help me understand the formula or the methodology used to calculate the differences across the different regions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we periodically do a area factor study to look at the different regions of the state. We have to do it at least every 5 years. And I don't have the report with me, but there are a number of rate regions. I'd be happy to provide that as background to the committee. That might be the best thing. But it's looking at different utilization, different types of services, and how do costs differ from one area of the state to the other.
Representative Hamilton.
If they could provide that, that would be... I'd be grateful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Each member has their own storage holder for all this material, so thanks again for that, for the plans. I've got Hosh, Gunhagen, McDonald, Liebling, Murphy, and Lanning. So Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to make this quick. First question probably for Ms. Pede is, the actuarial soundness, the data that's given to you from the MCOs, who is able to validate that information that's given to the department?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, the data that's given to the health to us by the health plans is certified by their CEO as true and accurate to the best of their knowledge. And so anytime we collect information that may be used in rate setting, we're required to have a certification or an attestation. That's not the same as an actuarial soundness certification. It is the state's actuary who certifies the rates.
And I'm trying to guess which of the panel wants to talk. So I see Mr. Feinwax leaning forward. So do you want to comment too? And then you can, you still have the floor. So do you want to let Mr. Feinwax go, and then you can go where you want to go first?
It's your committee, Mr. Chair.
Oh, go ahead. You can.
Okay.
Mr. Hosh.
Well, from that response, okay, so it is the health plan CEO that signs off on the soundness of the data or the accuracy of the data. That almost seems like a function that the legislature or the department should be doing, in that it's not just, we're taking this information, trusting it as accurate or complete. I have a concern with that. Do we have an outside independent agency that can go in and validate the information that's provided to the department?
Ms. Pede.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, I misspoke when I said CEO. It's generally the chief financial officer, so someone with financial background who's speaking to the accuracy of the data. I know, a small thing. Some of the information that we get is from the financial statement that's provided to the Department of Health, and I believe that the health plans want to respond about how that information is reviewed. And then we would be looking sometimes at additional detail or requesting additional detail. And then anytime our actuary sees what looks like a discrepancy, we would be going back and checking to see what the differences are. Is it a matter of different utilization? Is it a matter of some data got left out of the submission? So it's not completely taken on blind faith. I think I need to let someone speak to the state of what's submitted to the health department or to
Commerce. Representative Hosh, do you want? Okay. Mr. Feinwachs and Ms. Wooster.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, I think that is precisely the issue, and I think you're onto something very important. I think that the system that we have here is a system of self-attestation, where the plans themselves basically certify the rate, and our actuaries, Milliman, pass along that rate to the federal government. But I'm not sure anybody looks at it, and I will tell you, I'm leaving tomorrow to consult with the Florida Hospital Association, where this system is basically being pitched to them now. And in the materials that's being presented to them by Milliman, it in fact says that we will take the material as attested to by the HMOs themselves, but we don't really audit it. Now, I don't know if that's exactly the same here. Maybe it's different, but that's the way it works down there. And I feel compelled to tell you this for two reasons. One, because I think it's important to the question you raise, and two, it screws up my unemployment compensation for the coming week. But
Ms. Wooster.
Well, the answer that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the answer that was given about the attestation and that it's signed off by the CFO is correct. There are extensive audits on our financial processes that occur, and so it's not just that somebody is saying, gee, these are accurate, that works for the plan. We are audited. We're not audited by a legislative entity looking at the encounter claims, but there are outside auditors that must come in and independently validate how our processes are working. Are the claims that are being processed done both on a timely manner and accurate to the best of their knowledge? So it's not as though there's not oversight on how we operate.
Hush, you got a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where could we find those audits?
Ms. Wooster.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are audits included in your packet. And one point that may be also of interest, I know there's been concern that gap accounting is how many other organizations operate that the state works with, and the health plans are working under the statutory accounting principles. I have here, in case anyone wants to see them, the UCARE last ones that were done. We do both. The state required us to use the statutory accounting principle audit because it is better for assuring financial solvency of plans, but our organization does both, and we would be open to sharing it, but they are occurring.
Are you done? Okay.
Well, one last question, Mr. Chair, and along these lines, I mean, one of the things that I'm concerned with is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you provide the actuarial data to the Department of Human Services. Your last year's claims experience or costs are rolled into the rate settings for the next year. It seems like there's no risk involved in that in that process because you just make up for whatever your costs were from the last year. Also, correct me if I'm wrong from somebody on the committee, but our fee-for-service clientele or population is generally a sicker population than our managed care population. So we're talking about comparing apples to apples, and it was discussed that, well, we should compare the benefits of MCOs to fee-for-service. They're completely different populations. And another thing that I'm wondering is what precipitates or what causes a person to move from a managed care environment into fee-for-service?
Ms. Wooster or Ms. Pete? Ms. Wooster, go ahead. You can both go.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think there's several questions that were there, and I'm when we talk about the comparison to fee-for-service, there are some states with no managed care, for example, that could be used. When Ms. Pede was talking about the way the rates were put together, she did mention looking at other states and Medicare information. So I think it's important to recognize that it's not just the health plan information that has gone in, although that, for all of the plans, is showing you local experience. But maybe a simple example to give you of comparison with fee-for-service. Many of the health plans operate in the state with special needs basic care. It's a voluntary program. People can choose to participate or not. UCARE recently closed a Medicare managed care program called MINDO, Minnesota Disability Health Options. At the close of that program, 85% of the individuals in that program selected another managed care option. People have choices when they are in fee-for-service if they're interested to participate in a program, and they can leave if they're not happy with the program or if it's not meeting their needs. So there are clear examples. And although managed care is the operating model for prepaid medical assistance in Minnesota care, people at the end of the year when they have an open enrollment period in very small numbers decide to choose to leave their particular health plan for another option.
Ms. Pete.
Mr. Chairman, I want to respond to the question about where's the incentive or I guess I think of it in terms of how is it that you set rates based on managed care experience and don't, in essence, wind up pouring money down a hole. And part of the way that we do that is to look at a different kind of a benchmark, which is typically Medicaid fee-for-service or other managed care Medicaid states and Medicare, to give us information about trends for the populations that we have enrolled in managed care that does not come from our own health plans. So that's one thing that we do. The other thing that I want to respond to is the idea that when we set rates for example, 2011, that we somehow go back and make up for losses in a previous year. We don't do that. We never make whole a plan who lost, you know, $10 million last year. We don't add that to the base. We can look at costs, but we don't pay back for losses incurred in the previous year. What we want to do is have the rates be appropriate on a going forward basis. We're not trying to correct what was not sufficient last year, if that's clear.
I've got Grunhagen, McDonald, Liebling, Murphy, and Lanning, and Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the handout by Director Silversmith, page 7, and a question about that. It shows the way I understand it, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, is the payout rate versus inflation of Medicaid and Medicare. And then the slide below it shows the managed care rate increases and, I assume, additional funding that the plans are receiving. Is that correct, Ms. Silver, Director Silversmith?
Yeah, Ms. Silversmith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the two slides that you're referencing are really two ways for us to try to provide information. I apologize, there's a chair in my way. Information and context for the relative, in our position, underfunding or lack of investment in the state fee-for-service rates. So the first slide that you referenced shows the trend in the cumulative percentage change in fee-for-service rates for Medicaid. It splits in 2009 for primary care and non-primary care services because the legislature held harmless primary care services but implemented cuts in non-primary care services relative to a benchmark for inflation. The next slide is really just another way for us to introduce our relative flatline trend compared to the managed care increasing trend rate, but we acknowledge that the factors that drive the trend in the increase in the managed care rates are multifactorial, including increases in enrollment and utilization. But so it's really just a point of comparison.
Okay. Go ahead. Representative Grunhagen.
Mr. Chair, just follow. So my understanding is that Medicaid or medical assistance in this area that we're discussing has received increases in funding in almost every year for about 6 to 9% is the figure that was given to me, and yet the reimbursement rate to the doctors and the dentist and the hospitals has remained relatively flat with any increase. And basically Medicaid as a whole reimburses at about 20% less than Medicare. So to get to the point of my question is, if I take a dollar and I run it through the Medicare system, 20% more of that dollar gets to the doctors, the dentist, and the hospital than if I run that same dollar through the Medicaid system. And even with increases, it seems like the money is getting bottled up in the vendor system somewhere where it's not getting to the providers.
Mr. Barge.
Would you address that, please?
Mr. Barge, I think you just think. Do you want to say something about that?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. If I could, I do want to make sure that we are acknowledging the difference between the fee-for-service rates and the managed care rates. The fee-for-service rates paid by Medicaid have been flat to physicians and other professional services since 2000. In 2000, there was an across-the-board 3% increase. There have been none since other than cuts in 2009 and 2010 to non-primary care services. We, as part of our efforts in 2009 to amend current law for the required reporting requirements of the health plans, added provisions to get information about the payments from managed care plans to physicians and other providers to understand if there are similar or different trends in the rates paid by the managed care plans. That was the report that was released on Friday by the Department of Human Services. And our understanding based on that is that there are not increases in rates paid to providers of medical services from managed care plans unless there are increases in the fee-for-service rates. The report concluded that most of the plans link directly to the state fee schedule, so there are no increases unless that happens, and that has not occurred since 2000.
Mr. Bart.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think the other thing to note, and Ms. Silversmith mentioned this, is the reason that you see total Medicaid expenditures increasing year over year is the increase in number of individuals who are in our state public programs and the increase in utilization, meaning the number of services that are provided to people in those programs. The Department of Human Services has not increased their fee schedule. So what paying a provider 20 cents on the dollar 10 years ago, you're paying them probably 17 cents on the dollar today. When the Department of Human Services contracts with the health plans, the payments that the department gives us are based off that fee schedule. So since they haven't increased the fee schedule, they haven't increased payments to us based on an increase in the fee schedule. It's been based on utilization and enrollment. Despite the fact that our payments are based off the DHS fee schedule, the report that Ms. Silversmith mentioned that was released last Friday shows that the managed care plans pay providers above the fee schedule for every service category, or in some cases, some health plans may pay at the fee schedule. But despite the fact we're being paid at the fee schedule to provide services, we're reimbursing providers above the fee schedule. In some cases, significantly above the fee schedule.
Rep. Goodhanger, short follow-up?
Just wanted to get Mr. Feinwalk's perspective on that.
Oh, Mr. Feinwalk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, my perspective is simply this, that when we talk about, you know, these kinds of audits and these expenditures, There's no real audit, nor are there definitions of administrative expense, so we don't really know we have a way of auditing that. The other thing is, last year we suggested cutting in to the rates as part of the pain of cuts to the plans, and we were told that that would violate actuarial sufficiency and actuarial soundness, and that's not available. And the only thing we can do is cut providers. Now, I personally don't believe that's correct. I think we can do that, and I would urge you going forward that we need to look at doing that so that there is some sort of shared responsibility and shared accountability. And going back to Representative Huntley's comments, you know, maybe we have everybody put some skin in the game so everyone's at risk.
And members, we have four questioners and 10 minutes, so maybe if you can ask your question short. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Besides watching the Super Bowl this Sunday, I was reading the this particular packet here, and I can't wait to read this particular packet here. Maybe I'll finish by next Super Bowl. Anyway, this is a packet. It's a study by Governor Pawlenty. It was a health care transformation task force. Representative Huntley was on it, and several others, Cal Ludeman, and I'm surprised that Representative Abler, Mr. Healthcare, wasn't on this as well. But I want to read something very important. I want everybody to listen here because I think it'll resonate with a lot of questions that we've all been asking. On one of the pages, it says, in this study, the variation in quality that we see in our healthcare system today is unacceptable, and there is room for quality improvement everywhere. We need to come together as a community to agree on what constitutes high-quality care and encourage competition among providers and how best to achieve the highest possible quality at the lowest cost. Remember, this is from 2008. Continue to say, and I'll just read this shortly, the way that we pay for healthcare today is not, we do not reward quality and value. Under the current system, common sense approaches to deliver healthcare that would lower cost and improve the quality are not paid for or supported. In fact, providers who do a better job of managing care and keeping people out of the hospital may lose money compared to those who don't manage care well. So for health care providers, there are limited financial incentives for prevention, care coordination, quality innovation, and values. And as consumers, we ask for quality and cost values. 2 years later, or 3 years afterwards, seems that we're still asking these questions of how come there's not transparency, what happened to the quality, where's all the cost going. So my question is this. I certainly don't want to be sitting here 2 years from now, and no one else does, I'm sure, with another study that we spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on with no answers. This study was probably done to help come up with reform. My question is, has anything in this study been done so we can improve the quality care and spend the most cost-affordable money to the taxpayers' citizens' money?
Representative McDonald, it's been over a decade, by the way. But Mr. Leitz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, to your question about what's been done with that study, you know, a lot of the things that were included in that study, the Scott Leitz, DHS, were included in the 2008 health reform bill, which was passed. And many of the things that you're alluding to, which relate to sort of the provider incentives and how we can incent providers to deliver higher quality, lower cost care, I think is very much what we're interested in as at the department in moving forward this session as it relates to things such as accountable care organizations and putting in place the right incentives for providers to actually deliver care and be rewarded for those innovative, cost-containing, chronic care management types of things that were started in the 2008 legislation that was passed into law. A lot of the things around transparency were included there, including things like provider peer grouping and common quality measurement that are now up and running and doing well in the state. We want to really build on that, on those systems, and take them even further so that we don't have to say 3 years from now have another study that is going to recommend many of the same things. So we actually couldn't agree more with some of your comments and think we need to push much further and faster on a number of those areas.
And Ms. Wooster, maybe 1 minute, and then we'll move on. Representative Liebling, waiting very patiently.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just to respond to the question about some of the things that have happened, unfortunately, what is not in the payment report are areas that have been changing in the environment. Pay-for-performance payments, care coordination payments, and some of the ways that providers work differently with health plans and disease management are not payments that are represented in the report, but they are changes in the systems that are already happening today. Not just in response to that report, but how the health plans and providers are working differently together in Minnesota.
Representative Liebling, do you have a follow-up?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Not a follow-up. This is my first comment.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I know. I speak so often, you think I'm following up.
Okay.
But I do want to echo a lot of what's been said here. I think it's great that there is a lot of, I think, shared concern here among all of the members of the committee about making sure that we get value for our very scarce tax dollars in the state. So, but I have a couple of questions that are follow-ups from what Mr. Feinwachs brought up, that things that he raised that I really wonder if we can get answers to here today. One of those I would like to ask the plans. He said, how can managing an HMO or be more profitable? How can our book of business here be more profitable than the private book of business, if that's true? First of all, I don't know, what would you say? Is that true? And if it is true, how can it be true? And then I have a follow-up to that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Barsh?
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, depending on any calendar year, a health plan may have gains or losses in their public program business, and they may have gains or losses in their commercial business. They may have gains or losses at the same time or at separate times. So if you look at one calendar year, you could see a health plan who generated earnings off of their public program business and losses on their commercial business. You could look at a health plan a different calendar year and see that they made earnings on their commercial business and losses on their public program business. The chart that Ms. Wooster had in her presentation, which is in your packet, shows that for the state public programs business, earnings and losses fluctuate above the zero line. That's the same for commercial, too. Sometimes they line up, sometimes they don't.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I guess I'd like to see that second graph. You know, that's really important. Yeah. My second question is really to Ms. Peed, and it goes back to Mr. Feinwachs raised the issue about who are the actuaries, who is determining actuarial soundness. I mean, there was some discussion about that, but I didn't really hear the answer. You know, is that being, Mr. Feinwachs raised the issue that that's not being done according to any standards. You know, who does that? What standard is used for that? And also, where does that requirement come from? Is that a federal requirement, or is that something just in state law?
Ms. Speed.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, the requirement that rates that receive federal financial participation for medical assistance is a federal requirement. The standard is developed by the American Academy of Actuaries, and it's a sort of a pragmatic set of screens that the rates have to meet in terms of being sufficient to cover, as I mentioned, who's in the contract, what services have to be provided, what other duties are necessary, geographic differences. When a state sets rates as we do, they retain an independent actuary. So an actuary that doesn't work for the plans doesn't work, you know, is not a state employee to make that judgment. And then that is submitted to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Strategies, CMS. When we submit our contracts, CMS approves or does not approve the contract. We've not had an issue having our rates approved, but if we were to submit rates that were not determined to be actuarially sound, there would be no federal financial participation.
Representative Liebling, does that answer your series of questions?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Almost. I guess I wonder, where can we find these standards? And, you know, I guess I'd just like to know a little more about that. And we've got some insurance folks on this committee who probably know more about actuarial issues than I do, but, you know, I think that's something that this committee should get more information on.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, we can provide a link to the definition and also to the appropriate website.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Feed and Representative Liebling. Okay. Just to mention, we are going to go a few minutes over. We have a couple more questioners, and we've been informed we can take just about another 5 minutes. So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the PowerPoint from the Council of Health Plans and just have a couple of questions about that. For either Ms. Worcester or Ms. Peed. So I'm looking at page 7 that deals with the administrative costs and session law from 2008. It says that the administrative cost paid to the managed care plan is kept at 6.6%, and I'm wondering what the relationship between that is and the administrative costs incurred by the managed care plans. If the administrative costs are incurred by each plan are capped at 6.6%, or if it's just what is paid from DHS to the MCOs.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we set the cap is actually 6.6 plus license and fee, so it's 8.2% that we're permitted. That's done in aggregate. The plans vary as to their actual experience. There is further language that allows DHS to impose penalties for plans that have too much increase in a given year. We're participating in the Department of Health process to determine a consistent method for allocating administrative expenses, and then we would be in a position to implement the remainder of that statute. Typically, though, or to speak very generally, large plans tend to have more experience that they can aggregate their that they can allocate their administrative expense across. Smaller plans with less enrollment, and particularly plans that only deal with Minnesota state healthcare programs, have all of their experience attributed to our contract. So, for example, a small plan like Itasca Medical Care is likely to have higher administrative costs than a large commercial plan.
Representative Murphy, Mr. Feinwax would also like to address your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, a couple things. One, under the aggregate model, it's difficult to know for sure what's going on under the aggregate model. But the other part of your question is, there is a document called Health Practice Council Practice Notes from the American Academy of Actuaries that deals with actuarial certification of rates for managed for Medicaid managed programs. You can download this from the internet. I have a copy with me, and I'd be pleased to provide you with it. It provides some detailed insight into how things should be done, and I urge you to look at it if you have the patience and the wherewithal, and then compare it to how we think things are being done.
Thank you, Mr. Feinwax. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Feinwax, I'd be delighted to have a copy and share it with members who'd like it. I'm going to go to a different page, and that is page 15, where we're talking about the benefits of the MCOs. And bullet three talks about providing individualized care management services, et cetera. I'm wondering how these are evaluated by the MCOs or by the Department of Human Services.
Ms. Wooster?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as we work on certain programs with the state, for example, Minnesota Senior Health Options and Special Needs Basic Care have contractual requirements that individuals have care coordination. In the prepaid medical assistance in Minnesota Care program, we do analysis to determine which individuals in our program would best benefit from care coordination services, and obviously in doing due diligence on that, we identify both health outcomes and cost savings for targeting those efforts.
Madam Chair, if I could just follow up.
Representative Murphy, thank we do Madam have Chair. Just a couple more minutes and we have another questioner yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you might not be able to give this to me today, but if you could give me what you think is spent by the health plans on the individualized care management care coordination, that would be helpful for me.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I'd be glad to do that. I'd like to sit down and understand exactly what you'd be looking for in that to make sure we're responding appropriately to that question.
Thank you,
Ms. Wooster.
And Madam Chair, I just want to make one comment. This is an important hearing, obviously, you can tell by the room. I have to say that all of this does not necessarily equal for me transparency. I'm grateful to get this, and I get that we're wrestling with this issue, but that isn't equal to transparency, so we need to keep working on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And Representative Lanning, you were...
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think all of us around the table have two goals in mind. Number one, we want to make sure that we're buying quality service for the people that need it. But we also, secondly, want to make sure that we're not paying more than we should be paying for that service. And I had a question similar to along the lines that Representative Liebling was asking. And we've gotten a partial answer, but I think we need more of an answer. I'd like to see the trend line on profitability, not just for 1 year, as the Star Tribune article talked about, but over a longer period of time. And if that ratio of 4.1% profitability versus 1.6 commercial has been there for repeatedly over time, we've got an issue that we need to address. And so I don't know who can provide that to us, but that's information I would like to see. And we don't have time, obviously, to do this, but I'd like to know more about how DHS approaches this issue to make sure that we're not paying more than we ought to be paying. And by the way, profit's not a bad word.
Yes.
But excessive profits at the expense of the taxpayer should concern all of us.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. And to any of you there that may have additional information as far as a set of a snapshot, a one-year picture, which does not necessarily accurately portray what is happening, we would encourage all of you to send to the committee trend line data, benchmarks, year-by-year comparisons would be excellent. And just to mention, auditing where you put the numbers does not necessarily equal it was good to put them there. And so I think as we approach that in the future, we'll look forward to that. And with that, this meeting is adjourned.